This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Join us as we talk to another leader who works with others in the community.
We really had an excellent conversation with Monica Guzman in our previous episode. Now we're going to continue with the second part of our conversation we had with Monica. As you listen to this next episode, I think you'll hear some interesting things that talk about such things as the necessity for a temperamental revolution in politics, which is a fascinating idea she'll tell you more about. And she talks a little bit about journalism, where it is now, and why she has hope for journalism and the media playing a positive role going forward.
Hello and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, April Chatham Carpenter, and I'm here with my co-host, Glenn White. And get ready for today's conversation. We're going to continue our conversation with best-selling author and Braver Angels national leader, Monica Guzman. And in our first part of the conversation with Monica, we already have been hearing about the importance of trust being a prerequisite for our conversations, to not speak in ways that make other people feel left out, to think about and being mindful of the tools when we're maybe in more of the less comfortable conversations that we're using, and a lot of information on certainty versus curiosity related to her best-selling book titled I Never Thought of It That Way. One of the things that you mentioned in a conversation since you've been in Little Rock at being hosted by University of Arkansas at Little Rock, Monica, was a statement, and this was actually mentioned briefly in a dinner. So I would love for you to unpack it a little bit for us. And this is, you mentioned that the people that are underrepresented in our lives are often overrepresented in our imagination. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, it begins with a real quirk of the human mind, which is that when we don't know, we make it up. I was a technology journalist for many years, and there's sort of a respect that I have for the almighty computer, which when it doesn't know, it just leaves it blank. We don't do that. We make assumptions. So the question I think is so important to ask ourselves is, what kinds of people do you talk about, but never with? Again, our brains are not very rational in terms of the judgments that we make about others. So we live in sort of silos now, where we want to be around people who share our values, share our political language, that makes us feel more comfortable, you know, more in the right. And so we lean in on that. And then when someone in there writes the big thought piece with all the statistics that explains why those other people think what they think, we believe it. So that's really ultimately what it is a lot of us are walking around with a lot of assumptions in our minds. And we do not go and check those assumptions with the reality by engaging in actual conversations with actual people that can cut past the BS of our media that is not necessarily intentional. It's just a product of these fears and exaggerations. So that's it, is whoever is underrepresented in our lives will be overrepresented in our imaginations. And we might be making them out to be worse than they really are. And the practice to fix this is to check what's in our imagination with the reality. And that's one of the many reasons we have to have these conversations. We have to welcome this friction, because we have to see reality, and we won't see reality if we don't do it.
So I know one of the ways of doing that is to actually embrace having conversations with people who are different than you, rather than demonizing them. I also think about the kind of sources that we take in terms of the news and media sources, and wondered as a journalist if you had suggestions on how we can break out of our silos regarding those kind of inputs as well.
You know, people have made the point to me that it's not like we're sitting in our media silos and never being exposed to different perspectives. That's not really the problem. We are exposed to those different perspectives. Someone will retweet and quote tweet, you know, with a snarky comment, something that somebody said right on the other side, some big politician or whatever, or in the media. It's that when those other perspectives reach us, they tend to be covered in those layers of judgments from people on our side. So yeah, I can give some practical, tactical suggestions. So one thing I have done in my own life recently, and this has been sort of a game changer, is I can say very confidently that I was addicted to the New York Times. The New York Times I find to be a wonderful publication with some of the best journalists in the world. But there is a point of view in there. And, you know, it's taken me a while to sort of see it and admit it, and a lot of conversations with folks for whom the New York Times really doesn't seem to reflect their view of the world at all, to see it very clearly. And so just before the new year, I quit the New York Times cold turkey, and I have not gone to their site since. And this is the most that I have not been in the New York Times in at least 20 years, 15 years. And so I have replaced that. I'm slowly, slowly building up a media kind of thing, but very carefully. What I'm trying to do is not be reactive. I used to subscribe to a lot of newsletters, let media just kind of swarm in, follow it, sometimes anxiously. Here's a headline that's freaking me out. I better go read it. Here's another one. You know? And I've cut all that out because I don't want to be reactive anymore. I don't want to be following those little things in a state of panic or anxiety anymore. So I have subscribed first to a newsletter called The Flip Side. And The Flip Side is started by a woman named Anafi Wahed. And what it does is every weekday, it takes just one issue in politics, and it gives you a curated set of excerpts of the best analysis and opinion from the right and the best analysis and opinion from the left. And I got to tell you, it's fantastic. Through The Flip Side, I have discovered voices on the right that I didn't know existed that are awesome. You know, and for me, that's interesting because I'm on the left. So, and this isn't necessarily an advertisement for The Flip Side. There are other curated, you know, newsletters that do this. But I think the main point for me was I need to stop being reactive when I read the news. I need to stop following the headline and taking the bait. I need to come at it thoughtfully. And just like what I was saying earlier with my conversation with someone red, right, where we were saying that, you know what, if you don't look at the whole, how the right and the left tend to see something, you'll get even more kind of trapped in this idea that only one side is accountable, which is just not true. So it's helping me see the whole. And I think that that's what I want to continue doing is I want to have a media diet where I can see the whole, even when I'm zooming into one slice of anything.
So this brings up a question I have, and it is something I've thought for some time about media and journalism. You know, I think in many ways nowadays, what I keep hearing is media and journalists possibly playing the role of scapegoat to a degree. Now, there's no doubt in most people's minds that the media plays a huge role, social media especially, but other as well, that can be problematic. But there's also the truth that there are good journalists out there. And there's also the role of journalism is just basically reporting what other people say. And I think a lot of times people are getting mad at the media when they should be mad at the person who's giving them the story the media is reporting on. So as a journalist, what is your take on this whole idea of journalism and media and the role it plays in producing and increasing polarization in our country?
Yeah, I think that there are two institutions that play into polarization deeply, but also are critical to getting us through it and out of it, and that's the media and politics. So they are staffed by people who, if you talk to them one-on-one, are extremely well-meaning and want to do good work, see the way that their institutions are causing the problem, they see the ways that happens, and just aren't sure how to untangle it all on their own. So I sort of believe that the media, of course they contribute to polarization, but it's part of a larger system. The media is a mirror institution. They have to reflect culture. They have to reflect people. They have to speak to people, or else people won't pay any attention. So the rage, the resonance, the anxiety that exists in the public is going to be reflected in the media, and it's going to be amplified oftentimes. And so we see that. Social media, you know, rewards what's emotional and outrageous. And so we see that too. it's all there, but it's part of a larger system. I think that the major reason I'm coming to understand for myself that the major reason that journalism is in such disarray, and by the way, I'm optimistic. I think there can be a very healthy disarray, and that once we figure some things out, we're going to be much stronger as an institution than we ever were. And I'm excited about that. And I see the muscle building right now. I think the reason that journalism and media is in such disarray is because it is a truth-telling institution working in a society that has lost trust. And truth relies on trust. And journalism, as of yet, was never tasked with helping us build trust. Not really. And I believe that it didn't have to, because trust relied on organic human relationships across difference at a small scale spread all across this nation. We're burning those bridges, which gives journalism less channels to travel in between groups. And combined with the economic incentives of digital media, they have to play to loyal audiences. They have to build loyal audiences however they can, or they can't survive. So this is all just spinning us off in the wrong directions. But the good news is everyone in journalism sees this and knows this. It's just really, really hard to undo.
That's encouraging to hear that, you know, media and journalism sees this to a degree, and that you have hope, because it's easy to lose hope in these times. Well, you know, another thing that we do, and as you know, in Braver Angels, is look for common ground. That's one of the things that brings people together. I wonder if you have any thoughts about maybe particular policy issues, ideas, or stances that maybe there might be some good common ground found between reds and blues, that if we, you know, focus on that, perhaps we'd build some of that trust and reduce some of the distance between the sides. Any thoughts there?
I mean, I think common ground is everywhere. I guess I haven't thought about it that deliberately, but I'd be surprised if there was any contentious issue where there wasn't some common ground. You know, so to take the one that people keep telling me, there's no common ground here, abortion. The common ground that I've seen many folks on the right and left arrive at is there ought to be fewer unwanted pregnancies. I think everybody agrees on that. And that's a really fun starting point. Fun, I know, is a weird word to use here. It's a very heavy topic. But I've had the privilege of this being the issue that I mentioned my parents, that I've talked with my mother about the most, in the most heartfelt ways. My mother is deeply, deeply pro-life. Comes from a very moral place for her, and for her, a scientific place. Like, the way she sees the science, there is just no denying that life begins at conception. She can't understand how you could see it any other way, right? And for her, that's science. Cool, okay. I'm very pro-choice. I shouldn't say very, but I'm pro-choice technically. And the conversations we have had, the most delightful, have been the ones where we remind ourselves of that common ground. If only we could just have fewer unwanted pregnancies. And then we get creative, you know? And then we go, well, how could that work on a community level? Like, how could culture change to enable that a little bit more? What sorts of, I don't know, like, nonprofits could help? What sorts of social services? What about families? How can they, like, behave and take care of each other so that, you know, this happens more often and that kind of thing? And, yeah, and that can actually be fun, dare I say, really fun. So common ground allows us to get creative. Fear kills our creativity, absolutely destroys it. We become stupid when we're afraid. So yeah, there's common ground absolutely everywhere. There's a Van Jones did a speech at a New York Times event. It was only a 7-minute speech, but he talked about how he cares deeply about incarceration and what he sees as injustices in that system from the left. He worked very closely with Newt Gingrich on the right and got to understand that from the right, you know, they wanted a shared goal. It's like, let's fix this broken incarceration system. From the right, he said, Newt explained to him that what bothers us is the lack of redemption you know, spiritually in this system, and also the fact that it's a wasteful bureaucracy. And from the left, for Van and his allies, right, it was more about justice, justice, justice. There's so much injustice here. But they both shared that goal. So there's bipartisan legislation that's been passing over the last couple years to fix this broken incarceration system. And what Van Jones said was, don't let the battleground obscure the common ground. That's what he learned. And that is just right. Isn't it such a zinger? I just saw April make a face like, yeah, like, yeah. It's a good line. That's why they pay Van Jones the big bucks, man. But he's right. And you don't discover the common ground until you talk to someone on the other side and you realize, wait a minute, they might share your ultimate goal. They, you know, because we're all good people here. They're going to share your ultimate goal. So let's get creative about how to get there.
You know, that example that you gave there at the end, I really think about America in terms of its politics, because you mentioned the two institutions, right, that really need to be potentially changing to help with this polarization work. And I know we've got our own individual things, too, that we talked about in the first episode that we can be doing. But politics is the other one. And you have been, I know you're familiar because you were, have been in the role of a digital storyteller for Braver Angels. And so you've seen some of the work that's happened in terms of the Braver Politics Initiative within that. And I would love to hear some examples that you've heard about across the nation where people have worked across their own political parties to actually try to come up with common ground for policy reasons.
Yeah, man, without being immediately familiar with the details, there's a famous set of stories from Utah. After, when was it? It was a little bit earlier this century, with lots of same-sex marriage bills coming up in states like California and Utah. And the Mormon Church in Utah was very much against same-sex marriage at first. And what ended up happening was a series of very open conversations where leaders of the church began to meet with advocates for same-sex marriage. And it was remarkable. And they ended up getting to some of the most open legislation on this issue in the nation. Some things happened after that reversed some of that collaboration. But this is what I remember hearing from Jonathan Rauch, who's a very knowledgeable advocate in this space. But that was very exciting. I mentioned incarceration and the criminal justice system. There's been really wonderful sort of bipartisan legislation walking forward on that, which has been really, really neat. I'm most excited right now by politicians who are speaking up and standing up for almost like a temperamental revolution in the way we do politics. That's what I think is so important. So I'll cite a couple examples. Senator Ben Sasse, a Republican from Nebraska. He just ended his time in the Senate and is now going to be at the University of Florida leading there. But his farewell address to the Senate, I mean, I think nailed a lot of what's needed. And he made some points, you know, to his colleagues about, hey, let's not pretend that a lot of the yelling that we do in this chamber is really just an audition so that we can get booked to do more yelling on TV, you know? And he called them all in to that, you know? We can't pretend to be the deliberative body this country needs when we behave in these ways. So that was cool to hear him say that. And then Lieutenant Governor Denny Heck of Washington State invited me and several others, because I live in Washington State, bridge builders, to the State House for a 2-hour roundtable, because, you know, he's had it. He's really done. He's done with this, with this way of doing things. And he just wanted to hear all of our ideas about, you know, what can we do? The New Hampshire State Legislature, as you know, just completed a series of workshops with Braver Angels, including, I believe there's a pilot of a workshop we're doing for sort of depolarizing conversations, is that what it's called? Or better conversations with colleagues, that's designed for politicians. I've talked with, you know, members of Congress about this, the onboarding process to Congress. You would think there'd be some, I don't know, training, some talking about the importance of interacting with your colleagues across the aisle. There's none of that. There's none of that. You know, what rules in DC is the fight. And you're in your side and you're in your camp and there's just no integration. I mean, I just feel like Congress could use some real basics about onboarding in a mission-aligned way. You know, bring in the freshman Congress members and get them talking and get them to actually interact and get to know each other on a human level. We see how much that works. We know contact theory is everything. So yeah, so that's where I'm excited, is so much more common ground and policy work is that is responsible, is possible, if our elected officials are even just reminded or primed to deliberate on our behalf the way they're supposed to, have real debates about real issues and not just scream on TV.
They would actually move back to Washington and actually be in Washington and live there, so their kids would go to school and be on the same ball teams and other things. I mean, that's the contact theory, right? The more you are in contact with somebody that's different from you, the more you get to know them as being so much more nuanced and so much more of a beautiful human being as opposed to just their position or their party.
Yeah, and you know what's so fascinating is the generational gap is very significant in our political institution, because it was in the mid-90s where the congressional work week went from 5 days to three. So it was in the mid-90s where it became the norm to not live in DC and only fly there every week, fly in, fly out, fly in, fly out. The idea is that you're going to spend more time in your state, you know, fundraising, but building like authentic relationships. I don't know that happened as well as people hoped, but you also have zero chance to build relationships and build a life with your colleagues. So I've talked to so many politicians who were there before that moment and are just so nostalgic for that. They didn't realize what they'd lost. It's sort of like what we all didn't realize what we lost during the pandemic. How wonderful it is to be together. We didn't know, you know, we didn't know how good we had it until we had to Zoom all day. Like, ugh, you know? Yeah. And so I think those older politicians carry around a lot of wisdom, and I hope that they can insist enough that we need to return to that.
I like the idea of having some training before people actually go into Congress and do the things they're supposed to do. We actually here in Arkansas made a brief effort just a couple of months ago to see if we could do something like that with our state legislator, but we got a little bit of a late start and we've not had any luck with that so far, but maybe down the road before the next session, if we're lucky, we can do something like that. I think that's a great suggestion. So, Monica, where do you think we are now in America in terms of our politics and where the future might be taking us? And I want you to make sure that it's so easy to talk about all the negatives and how many bad things might happen, you know, how things just, you know, go off into the ditch. But and you seem like a fairly positive person, so I think this will come easy to you to kind of talk about some of the positive elements while still being realistic. What do you think are both hopes and concerns you might have about where our country seems to be headed?
I'll start with a concern. I was asked this recently, everything that happened with Roe v. Wade recently and the big changes in abortion laws across the nation. You know, technically what happened is that a lot about abortion is now up to the states. Okay. One of the big concerns I have about that with regard to polarization is that a lot of folks for whom, you know, the ability to do this or not do this, to have abortions is very important to them, now have the biggest reason of all to move to states that agree with them, which I think is just terribly consequential. So I've never seen a stronger force for geographic sorting than that. So the more that we have those kinds of policies that return things to the states or to different geographic regions, then the more that we're going to miss the whole and the ability, it's like we're giving up a little bit on our ability to figure this out as a whole. And so we're fragmenting even more because we think that that's what's going to lead to better lives. We're gambling on that. But by far I am full of hope. And it comes from, I've always been someone who pays attention to people. I do honor institutions. I mean, but to me, institutions are built to encode the best of what people have learned. So that's what an institution is. Institutions have to evolve and change after enough time has passed, when the values and assumptions that were encoded into an institution no longer hold. Well, then that institution has to change. And I just really believe that nothing, there is no agent of change that is not a person. You know, institutions aren't alive. Like, it's people. We're all people here. That's all. That's the only power in this world is people. So that's why I really believe that the degree of interest in this, what we are all working on, is profound across this country. It's amazing. And again, I have the privilege of seeing that because I've written a book that's kind of, you know, helping to lead this conversation. And so I'm going to all these sectors and industries and all kinds of parts of our society where people don't know the answer, but they know they have to figure it out. And so that's where it always begins. That's where it begins. So there's so much more awareness. There's so much more frustration with the status quo on this. And there's so much more experience bit by bit, you know, lights are going off and people are going, we can do this. Wait a minute. I could do this with this person. Why can't I do it with that person? Why can't I do it with that person? Why can't they do it over there? It's like, yeah, why can't they? Of course they can. So I think we just need to kind of wake up, a little bit on this, and it's already happening. So that's my main hope, is it's all people and people are waking up.
And of course, I think as you alluded, you didn't say it specifically, but I believe Braver Angels is one of the forces in this country that's really trying to make that transition happen. How do you think we're doing, and what do we need to do going forward to help facilitate this transition you talk about?
I think it's really important that people who are lit up by these ideas, and first that they are given ways to bring their best to this work. So if you enjoy moderating, you know, there's ways that you can help your neighbors come together. If what you enjoy is learning, well, great. There's ways that, you know, you can partner up and we can help you go and meet people who, you know, may think very differently from you. And that's going to help you, you know, take that to scale in your own mind and in your own community. If you're really good at some of the technical aspects, then cool. You know, this movement could use your skills. If you are a little bit like me and you get into ideas and you want to passionately talk about it, well, great. Like, people want to hear more about how this is possible. So, you know, we want you to be empowered to do that. I think that ultimately this is a movement, and movements require a big mix and grab bag of gifts and ideas and passions and models and tactics, right? So maybe you have contacts in the media institutions. Maybe you have contacts in the political institutions. Cool. Like, plug those in, because we have resources and we are building more resources together, and you can help build them with us. So this is not like a, we've got the script here and we just need little peons to plug in and play it out. No. This is something we have to do together, and we have to have people who believe all the things, all the things. I believe so deeply in this principle that there is no one not worth talking to. No one. Nope. It has to be the whole. It's the only way this works. So you care about this? Cool. You're in.
Wow, so much here, Monica, and we could spend another whole hour, but we're out of time for today, and I really just love all the emphasis that this is not just about saying the institutions have to change and feeling like I'm not empowered to do something. This is also about what can I do as an individual, starting with my own relationship, starting with my own media diet, starting with where my expertise is and how I might want to be a part. I know one of the things that Braver Angels is trying to do, coming up to our national convention that will be held right after July 4th at Gettysburg, is to try to bring in partners that are also in the working on needing to depolarize their membership in order to get things done, whether it might be a an organization that's trying to work on the political kind of side of things, or a church in which you've got divided people in your congregation and you know that we need to increase better relationships, to a Rotary Club that just wants to keep learning about how they can make a difference in their community. So as people are interested in those kinds of things, I encourage them to check out the braverangels.org website in general, and then as well our Braver Angels website for Arkansas, which we'll have a little bit of information here shortly. So thank you, Monica, for being our guest. It's been a real pleasure to get to know you better and to actually see you in person. And we appreciate your time with us and wish you the best as you travel around the country, helping us to learn how you say having fearlessly curious conversations in dangerously divided times. And listeners, if you haven't already, be sure to check out the first part of the conversation with Monica Guzman. And of course, we invite you to listen to other episodes of On the Other Hand with our many fascinating guests. And that's found at arkansas.braverangels.org/podcast, or you can check it out on your favorite podcast site.
When you visit our website, you can help us improve our program by responding to a brief survey. You'll find a link to the survey on our podcast webpage. You can also email us for program or speaker ideas or other feedback at otherhandar@gmail.com.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band. Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White.
And April Chatham Carpenter.
Have a good evening, and let's all work to bring our community closer together.